regardless of ideologically where those bases sit, their willingness, even appetite, to take to the streets and use non-traditional or informal means to express themselves, even sometimes violence, comes about because they simply feel that institutions aren't representing them.
Hello, and welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. I'm Lauren Zhao, and I'm joined by my co-host, Alexis Holowinski. On December 7th, 2022, within 24 hours, Pedro Castillo was ousted from office and jailed after attempting to unconstitutionally dissolve Peru's Congress. His successor, Dina Boluarte, is Peru's fifth president in just 2 years. Dr. Christopher Sabatini joins us today to discuss the future of democracy in Peru. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
Dr. Christopher Sabatini is a senior fellow for Latin America at Chatham House and was formerly a lecturer in discipline in the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. He frequently appears in the media on issues related to Latin America and foreign policy, and is the founder and former editor-in-chief of the publication America's Quarterly. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
Dr. Sabatini, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So on December 7th, 2022, now former president Pedro Castillo launched a coup that would ultimately fail and lead to his impeachment by Congress. Could you walk us through those events that transpired and why his failed coup was so shocking to many?
Well, it was a coup for only about 2 hours, actually. He had facing congressional investigations and probably a third impeachment after two previous attempts by Congress. He basically attempted to dissolve Congress and to reorganize the judicial sector and call a government of exception, as he called it. And basically, the Congress immediately rejected that offer or that decree and issued an arrest warrant for him. And he tried to flee and was detained by the police and is still actually in detention for an attempted coup. So it was a very, you know, as one observer said, it was Peru only had an authoritarian government for 2 hours. It was short-lived. In many ways, it harkened back to the attempt by Alberto Fujimori in 1992 to engage what is called a self-coup at the time, in which he also basically dissolved the Congress, reorganized the judiciary, governed by decree, although his was much more successful with very dangerous outcomes later, consequences in terms of corruption, in terms of human rights abuses and the like. This one, again, I probably looking backwards for the Congress, they saw the risks that was going on and immediately put an end to it.
So kind of leading up to this moment, Castillo's government was known to be prone to infighting and being very dismissive of the people's needs. Could you provide some context on the political situation in Peru during his presidential tenure, and what was the buildup to this unprecedented event?
Let me back up a little bit even before Castillo, because he came into office in the wake of a whole series of upheavals that had basically removed previous presidents and congressional sort of standoffs with the presidents. You had an attempt to impeach a previous president, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, who resigned before the impeachment. You had an interim president, Vizcarra, who was impeached, and an interim president. And then you had the election with Castillo, who inherited this both a deeply fragmented party system. In fact, it's even probably a stretch to call it a party system. Over 10 parties are represented in the single chamber of the Peruvian Congress. And those are pretty much dominated in that case by the party of the daughter of a former dictator, Alberto Fujimori. His daughter's Keiko Fujimori, who were, narrowly lost the election to Castillo. And Castillo was an unknown figure. He never held elected office before. He was a teachers union activist, local leader, came from the interior of the country, largely of indigenous descent. And his making it to the second round was just pure coincidence. The way in which you can try to study Peruvian elections, electoral volatility is, you know, the candidates rise and they fall and they rise and they fall. And whenever, basically, whoever happens to be on the rise at that particular moment when the elections are held tends to be the person who at least makes it to the second round. And this was the case of Alejandro Toledo, who was the one who followed, actually, Alberto Fujimori. You know, it is an incredibly volatile electoral system and a set of popular opinions towards elite. And if you look at surveys in Peru, the Peruvians are deeply distrusting of their Congress and the political class, and the volatility reflects that. So Castillo comes in ill prepared for the office, a very marginal small party, and appoints a group of people who are really not particularly well qualified to hold those offices. He reshuffles the cabinet 5 separate times, goes through, I think it was close to 50 different ministers. And so it's very fluid, very unstable. And at the same time, he's being hammered by the Congress, 2 impeachment votes and another. And he basically was confronting an investigation into corruption and nepotism involving his family. And knowing full well that the Congress was coming after him, and he's still a long time before the end of his term, he attempted to do what Alberto Fujimori did in 1992, which was stage a self-coup, an autogolpe, which was dissolve the Congress and reorganize the judiciary. This time, unlike in 1992 when Alberto Fujimori did it, the Congress said, no, can't do that, and basically removed him from office and then called for his arrest for an attempted coup. So that's the background to all of it. And it was, The institutional standoff and the behavior of the Congress up until then, and this is not to excuse what was clearly a coup attempt by Castillo, really reflects the deep hostility between the two offices, the constitutional or normative dysfunction and the design in the Constitution between the executive and the Congress. They tried to give more power to the Congress and ended up giving too much power to the Congress, that it could effectively paralyze and even remove presidents with very little cause. So you layer that on top of a deeply fragmented political party system, you get the standoff and then the really brazen attempt to dissolve Congress. And you know, the truth is Congress is, you know, I think it's 90% of Peruvians don't trust or have no confidence in the Congress. It's one of the least popular institutions, but obviously dissolving it was a step too far. And so he confronted, if you will, the sort of the Congress people and a large part of the political establishment that reacted. And there you have his attempted a coup and then his arrest and now the appointment of the vice president to succeed him, Boluarte.
So kind of talking more about the hostility between the two entities, I know Peru's implementation of this hybrid system has been very controversial. So we've talked a little bit about the detriments of this political system, but are there any benefits to it? And what other detriments are there?
The weaknesses fundamentally are an effort to create a Congress that has a little bit more say, and the hope is a little more stake in the survival of governments. The problem is it blended the worst of two systems, a presidential system in which presidents are elected separately and their terms are fixed, and a parliamentary system that had a prime minister, although it's still appointed by the president, although approved by the Congress, and a parliament that gave a lot of power to the Congress. And so what you had was this really unwieldy, dangerous combination in which Congress had a lot of power but didn't really have a stake in the survival of the presidency. In fact, quite the opposite. You know, in a parliamentary system, I can say this with the benefit of now living in the UK, you know, you have an executive, the prime minister, who's chosen by a parliamentary majority or coalition. Then the parliamentary majority has a stake in the survival of the prime minister until it reaches a point when he or she has to have a vote of no confidence. But even then, the parliament, the majority party, the majority coalition have a disincentive from convening new elections if they think they're going to lose them. It's snap elections. I mean, obviously, there's fixed terms. And prove that doesn't happen. The Congress has no incentive to cooperate with the executive. And yet they have a lot of power to harass that president. And so consequently, you get two independent bodies without very little shared incentives for survival.
Now, in the present, after swiftly impeaching Castillo, the Congress immediately instated, like you said, the Vice President Dina Boluarte as the first female president of Peru. So what are Boluarte's key policy goals and where does she find her support?
Right now, I think Boluarte's key policy goal is survival and peace. She does represent, in some ways, the sort of Limeño, the capital of Peru, Lima's elite and business elite, who, quite frankly, were probably happy. Many of whom were happy to see Castillo leave, given his be forced out of office, given his incompetence, quite frankly, and his inconsistency on policies and the instability within his government. But Boluarte, she's a caretaker. The funny thing is past in the past, we had several caretaker presidents. You had Paniagua, who succeeded Fujimori until Toledo was elected. You had Vizcarra, who was impeached, but he was popular for a while, actually quite popular. And then you had Francisco Sagasti, who was interim president. Paniagua and Sagasti were quite popular. Boluarte doesn't enjoy that for a number of reasons. One is sort of the controversy following Castillo's exit. Again, he was indigenous. He was from the interior of the country. And many people, many of his followers, and in fact, he was, by Peruvian standards, was relatively popular at the time of his coup attempt and then his removal from office. I think his popularity is around 30%, which is high, again, by Peruvian standards, given the fractiousness of the system and the volatility of public opinion. And I think her original goals were probably just to stabilize the country and get it through to the next originally scheduled presidential elections. Obviously, things then got out of hand. First of all, within the region, within Latin America, a number of countries saw this more as heads of government saw this as more of an ideological issue. And rather than acknowledge the fact that what Castillo tried to do was extra constitutional, was effectively a coup d'etat, condemned the Congress's arrest of him and rejection of him. Here I'm pointing to the governments in Bolivia, President Luis Arce, the government of Colombia under Gustavo Petro, and the government of Mexico under Andrés Manuel López Obrador. For them, the problem was Congress's removal of the president rather than what Castillo did. And within that, you also had a large segment of Castillo's followers, and in particular in the interior of the country, in the rural areas of the country, and large parts of the indigenous population, mestizo population, for whom Castillo was representative of, at the very least, their interests, but at a symbolic level, even the historically underrepresented, politically speaking, nationally speaking, indigenous and mestizo population. So for them, Castillo's removal was a slap in the face and an attack again by the much more European descendant elites of the capital city, Lima, and as well as a few other cities who erupted in waves of protest. And so now Boluarte finds herself trying to contain these protests, in some ways, unfortunately, very violently. As we speak now, more than 40 people have been killed in the demonstrations, most of them by security forces. But she tried originally to address this by moving up the elections to 2025. But that's going to be difficult because she can't. And now the protesters are demanding they move, be moved up even more soon, more quickly. But that is not in her capacity. And to get that done, she has to get the approval of the Congress. And that's probably not going to happen. So right now, you know, as much as she may have wanted, and the supporters of her government in Lima in particular may have wanted to see a steadier hand on the helm of government, in particular also when it comes to foreign investment and political stability, she finds herself confronting just waves and waves of protests, primarily, again, in the interior of the country and what's in the mountainous areas and largely the indigenous areas.
And has Boluarte's government's reaction to the protests had any effect to quell them, or have they continued?
Quite the opposite. The heavy-handedness has, this always happens when the security forces respond with excessive force, it only adds more fuel to the fire, and that's precisely what we're seeing. There's an attempt now to establish a state of siege and a curfew that's hoped will tamp this down. But, you know, the protesters' demands are ones that are going to be very difficult to meet. Castillo is not going to be returned to office, and that's one of their primary demands. The other is a new constitution and far earlier elections. A new constitution would be a very fraught process in Peru. Some people have argued for this, but in this particular environment, which these levels of polarization, how you would go about, we see this recently with Chile, despite a noble effort to try to rewrite their constitution, it's difficult to do it in the middle of social upheaval. And the other issues, and it would be up to her also to amend the constitution. That would take a vote of Congress. It's unclear what's going to happen. I don't know how she appeases some of these forces, given the very unrealistic expectations of the protests. By the same token, the brutality of the security forces has tended to augment them and have a horrible toll. Now, some people are claiming, and it's going to be investigated by the Human Rights Ombudsman in Peru. And I think that may help in some ways, getting some. Then the Ombudsman's office is a widely respected institution in Peru. Hopefully that will establish some clarity and some accountability for what happened and satisfy some of the demands for justice. But in terms of long-term demands, it's going to be a rough ride for the next couple of months, maybe even years.
So if Castillo's ousting does not really mark the end of Peru's political turmoil, how do you kind of see, I guess, in detail, Peruvian politics and democracy changing in the future? We've already seen over the past 5 years, 6 Peruvian presidents coming and going. How do you see the stability of the government?
This is ultimately the question. And I honestly don't know the answer. And the truth is the challenges and the exits for Peru's current political turmoil are not clear, and they're unprecedented. There's not any real historical example of a country that has been able to reestablish a stable party system out of the very decimated nature of Peru's parties right now. And part of this is in part because of the traditional exclusionary nature of Peru's parties up until recently. They were primarily urban affairs, and Peru's indigenous populations were largely underrepresented in the country's national politics. Add to that the corruption and legitimate sort of public disapproval, even rejection of the classes now, and then this has created somewhat of a feeding frenzy among the political class. How you really recreate and implement the necessary reforms to first of all establish some sort of coherent, organic, consistent political representation in the country. That doesn't sort of descend into zero-sum politics and backbiting and atomized sort of groups. There's a term actually that was common a long time, because this has been going on for a long time, as you indicate, Lauren. There's a term in Peru that they talked about all these sort of mini parties that sprang up in the rural areas, in particular after the decentralization under the Toledo government. They call them Toyota parties. The reason is because all their members could fit into a Toyota. And the idea is, you know, how do you now restructure these into meaningful options, programmatic parties that are not just personalities or flash issue, single issue parties, or even ethnic based parties. And I don't know how that happens, because the truth is the larger issue of institutional reform are going to be very difficult to address if you don't have more meaningful collective political bodies. Again, the Congress is really, it's deeply discredited. It's also, you know, it does pursue a zero-sum scorched earth policy when it comes to politics. You know, how you redesign a meaningful congressional executive relationship when the Congress is so dysfunctional itself is very, very difficult. I don't mean to sound negative. In saying this, I'm not an apologist for the previous party systems. They were largely exclusionary. The voices we're hearing of sort of for greater representation, the demands for rural populations to have a greater say in national politics and have a greater say in investment policies and public policies are legitimate. But how you address those legitimate needs within a very fractured party system, a political system generally, is really unknown.
Finally, to maybe take a step back and connect some of our discussion about Peru to the region as a whole, there has recently been discourse about a potential so-called new pink tide happening in Latin America, a trend that's been compounded by Lula da Silva's win in Brazil and Gustavo Petro's election in Colombia. So how do you think Castillo's impeachment fits into this broader new pink tide narrative? And what does this situation mean for Latin America's left?
Alexis, I'll be honest, I'm not a big fan of the pink tide label. I understand why journalists are trying to figure out a shorthand to try to explain what's going on. The truth is, and I'll explain why I don't like the pink tide. The first is that what we're really seeing is an anti-incumbent wave. Because before that, everyone talked about a conservative wave. Before that, people talked about another pink wave. What happens is that basically political parties are failing to deliver. Governments are failing to deliver in ways that citizens want. And so what you're seeing is a constant churn. And not rather than, because pink tide implies that there's a certain sort of meaningful ideological shift that is occurring and that it will be somehow sustainable. And I suspect it won't be. And this is, Castillo is a perfect case in point. He just happened to be, he's sort of an accidental president, to be quite frank. Now we're seeing the backlash, but we're also seeing a certain element, probably a minority of people who want him to remain in power or believe he is a legitimately elected president and was legitimately elected. I should say that, but now obviously he violated his mandate. Whether it's Petro, whether it's Lula, first of all, in both of those cases, too, it's worth pointing out, Lula won in the second round against an odious right-wing, misogynistic, racist former army officer. But he won by only 1.8% of the vote in the second round. That's really close. So we're not talking like a massive pink tide, which gives us the impression like, oh, people now suddenly left. Same thing, with Gustavo Petro. He won in the second round to a man who was had serious allegations of corruption, had been mayor. Most of his campaign was conducted on TikTok, didn't actually do real campaign events. And it was a surprisingly close election. So what you're seeing isn't so much any sort of ideological, meaningful ideological wave, so much as just voter disgust, voter rejection, and electoral fluidity that is going to be very, very dangerous over the long term. Because it means that crafting long-term policy options, developing ways that you can address the very meaningful structural problems, whether it's state capacity to deliver social programs, whether it's the leakiness of social safety nets, whether it's the inherent discrimination of structural discrimination of labor markets, in which more than half of the people in the labor force are employed in the informal sector, Those are difficult. Whatever side of the ideological spectrum the president comes from, is going to be difficult to develop and address when the reserve of political trust and long-term vision has evaporated.
And I guess using this idea of constant churn and electoral fluidity that you mentioned, what do those mean for Peru's left and their ability to maybe harness those elements of just like public sentiment and opinion in order to enact the type of social policies that they've run on?
It means, first of all, the ability to bring in technocrats who, more than just ideologues, who, and, you know, there's a large portion of Peruvian technocrats who you know, come from the left, but who can design policies. So it means understanding the very structural nature of the problems that Peru faces and voters who may be voting for the left confront, especially rural and indigenous voters. It means also creating a more meaningful collective identity of the left. You know, one of the great leftist leaders of the historically of Latin America was Allende La Torre, who created the APRA party. He did create sort of this Creole nationalistic center-left party that had real programmatic ambitions. It was loathed by the military, but it was a mass movement with real structure. The current sort of array of groups that we see in Peru that are identify as the left or lack that collective identity. They lack that structure in any meaningful way that could both be able to manage and gather votes in the Congress to create a stable government, field a team of technocratic, qualified technocratic candidates in the executive in the state, and then also address a lot of the issues of investment, state capacity that need to be addressed that are essential. Because you have this weird dilemma in Peru, which is because of the country's very rich natural resources, whether it's gold or copper, natural gas, that it's been growing very quickly. Almost Asian levels, 5 to 7% per year on the basis of minerals and metals. The question is sort of how the revenue from that is captured, collected, and redirected in ways that the rest of the country benefits from that. And up until now, the truth is the benefits of that economic growth and the wealth from minerals and metals has disproportionately benefited the cities and a decentralization structure that is just woefully inadequate, poorly designed, and ineffective.
Yeah, and I know we've all been keeping up with the news of the storming of the Congress in Brazil, and we know how protests can be contagious. Do you see these kind of ideas and motivations from Brazil leaking into other Latin American countries like Peru?
Peru already had a movement of protest. We saw this happening first under Castillo, although it happened even as recently, as far away as 10 years ago, where local groups were sealing off highways or storming mining towns, closing down mines. When institutions don't function, when people don't feel represented, when they don't feel they have a voice in more formal means, they take to the streets in Latin America. Everywhere, but in Latin America, where trust in institutions is so eroded right now, yes, we're going to see more of it, and it's not an ideological phenomenon. We saw it with in the case of Bolsonaro, obviously, in many of these cases, they're stoking a particular base that has a view and that they know how to capture. But regardless of ideologically where those bases sit, their willingness, even appetite, to take to the streets and use non-traditional or informal means to express themselves, even sometimes violence, comes about because they simply feel that institutions aren't representing them. And that's going to be the case. How do you craft institutions that people feel represented by, especially when, again, take the case of Brazil, where the country is so deeply split down the middle. Again, Lula only won by 1.8% of the vote. It's a deeply divided country and not a, a huge mandate to basically help build the basis for reconciliation and consensus that's necessary.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Chris. This was really informative.
Thank you, Lauren. I hope you take care of your voice.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.